So I want to talk more about what we just did and what this concept of citta is. It's a really a, quite an enormous concept in Buddhism and Dharma practice, and it's oftentimes quite misunderstood. As many of us know, the languages from the Pali to Tibetan to Chinese to Sanskrit to Thai to Burmese. And then back to English, sometimes these ideas don't always get translated quite well. I also want to offer a little bit of a disclaimer because all schools of Buddhism certainly address the concept of citta in a wide variety of ways. So today I will specifically be speaking about citta from the earliest perspectives. So the way citta is defined and understood in the discourses of the Pali Canon, which most of us would know from the insight tradition, the way that it's understood through the teachings in the Pali discourses, and also what would be known now as early Buddhism. So, really, the early Buddhist perspective on citta. Also, including some of the aspects that's found in the Buddhist canon of the Abhidharma, which is also a Theravadin perspective. Pali discourse on Buddhist psychology. There's a lot, citta is very much unpacked in that teaching of Abhidharma. And even a little bit to the end, I'll talk a little bit how citta could be understood through the lens of emotional intelligence, or how many of us would recognize it in the modern aspect of things like emotions. So, how does emotion fall into the role of citta, and how can it be used in just the way that we all struggle in our daily lives with a variety of emotional experiences, and how can citta have a role in that? So, just want to kind of give you a little bit of a setup to let you know where I'm coming from on this. And I also just again want to respect the fact that this is an enormous concept in Buddhism, and there's probably a lot of ways different people talk about it. Defining citta is a very hard word to define. It's usually defined or known as consciousness, mind, probably most commonly known as heart mind. And in the third foundation of mindfulness, it falls in the third reflection, the third satipatthana, mindfulness of mind, which I don't know about you, but that's a very ambiguous thing, mindfulness of the mind. I've always has struggled with that. Well, what does that actually mean? Consciousness, mind, heart, mind, these words are not very, very descriptive, but they all point to this word citta, this heart mind. We would probably understand that now as the psycho-emotional process, the relational process of thoughts and emotions. Thoughts and emotions are a huge component of what make up citta. And then really in the rising and falling of moment-to-moment experience. So the phenomenological, what is it that's arising in my mind? Thoughts, sounds, sensations, and how do I relate to them? How do I understand them cognitively in my thoughts? Feeling, the vedana, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, and then the emotional tone of experience is how we would citta actually encompasses that wide of a range of experiences. In the Pali discourses, it's defined in three particular ways. So I want to talk about how it can be defined in a way that just might be give us some more respect for the complexity of the word. And two of them are nouns, and one of them is a verb. And so the first sense of citta is it's known as an agent, and that is just that which knows an object. It's the knowing of an object. To cognize is the root of the word citta from this Pali word chitti, which means to cognize. So I have this pen. I don't have to tell you with a pen, you probably figure it out. And citta just cognizes that as a pen. It's the agency that does that. It's also known as an instrument. So what it does, what citta does is it organizes other mental factors. So perception. So it allows perception that you know this is a pen. So you perceive this as a pen, you know that it's a pen. It also organizes around the feeling. You might have a pleasant feeling or an unpleasant feeling towards this pen, probably a neutral feeling. This actually isn't a very nice pen, but that Chitta organizes perception and feeling and mental activities. Chitta organizes all of the aggregates around a particular object, so it has an instrument-like quality to it. The third way that it's understood, and probably the way that it's most most adequate of the three, and what I'll talk about from here on out, is recognizing it as a verb, chitta as an activity, which is actually the process of cognizing itself. So if we look up here, this is a pen and I'm aware of the pen. Well, what goes on between me and the pen? So it's almost like looking at what is the mental attitude or the behavior in the mind that I have towards a particular object in any given moment. It's actually like a pair of glasses. So if I have these glasses on and I have the glasses of aversion on, I look at this pen and I just recognize all of the unpleasant qualities. This isn't a very nice pen. I don't really like this pen. It's an advertisement for a business. I don't even know what this business is. All I can see is the unpleasant aspects of this pen because I have on the attitude, the chitta, of aversion or resistance. So we're always, everything that arises in our experience, we're looking at it through a type of filter. So it's almost like we have, you know, like, I don't know, 50 different types of pairs of sunglasses, types of lens, but a lot of times we don't know that we have them on. We don't know that we're looking at the lens of resistance. We don't know we're looking through the lens of desire, through the lens of contempt, through the lens of judging, comparing, criticizing, all of these behaviors in the mind. And so a lot of times what we'll do is we'll project all of that onto the object. This is an unpleasant object. It's a bad object. We have a judgment, an opinion, a perception about this object. We feel like we don't deserve the object. We feel like the object is no good. We feel entitled to have the object. There's a whole wide range of ways in which we project all of our chitta onto an object. And we think that all of those qualities are actually in that object. But it's actually not. It's in the way we're processing, the way that we're experiencing, the way that we're really talking about the attitude of the mind, which is probably, I feel, the most accurate way to describe that. And so that would be our chitta. So it's really more of a verb. It's not a thing. Chitta is not a thing. It's a layer of relating. So it's in relational mindfulness, we talk about this a lot. What is my relationship to an object? What is my relationship to my job? What is my relationship to the political landscape? What is my relationship to food? What is my relationship to literally everything? And so it draws us back into looking at the way we are relating to a particular experience and really trying to take full responsibility for that. That it's not the object that has those qualities in it inherently. It's the way that we project onto those objects. So I hope that that's clear. I think that that's important because I know that for me, practicing for a number of years, this word chitta was something that I was always interested in. It always seemed very important. And part of the practice is to liberate the chitta from the forces of greed, hatred, and delusion. And so it's important to understand that it's a fairly complex thing, but it can be recognized. It can be something that can be known through meditative experience. And so it's really trying to look at it through the lens of behavior and attitude, the way that we relate to a particular object. And so when we think about practicing different ways of practice, I'm going to keep using my pen because I like this awareness object analogy, is that many of us are associated with meditation practice as being object oriented. So we know in mindfulness practice, we have like our breath, and that's an object. And then we pay attention to that object and we try to develop some concentration of mindfulness of breathing, paying attention to that object. And that creates experience of concentration or samadhi or collectedness, stability of mind. And when we move through the foundations of mindfulness, we recognize different types of objects. We notice that there's a feeling, that we have a pleasant feeling towards an object or an unpleasant feeling towards an object or a neither neutral feeling towards an object. So we start to see that we have this relationship to the object. We also see that we have an attitude towards the object. We want it. We don't want it. We're confused about it. We're not sure about it. And then in the fourth foundation of mindfulness, we have the mental activities or the dharmas. Dharma, again, another one of these terms that's hard to define, but really for meditative experience, it's the smallest discernible unit of experience. Noticing a sound as a sound, a finger as a finger, a pen as a pen. So we want to be able to identify, to recognize objects. So those of you who are familiar with practicing in a noting strategy, and which is very popular in the Burmese tradition of recognizing thinking as an object, planning as an object, remembering as an object. And we just recognize, okay, that's thinking. I'm going to let that go, come back to my breath. And a lot of this is kind of object-based practice. In the Manual of Insight or the Progression of Object-Based Practice, we focus on a single object, we gain stability, and then we start opening to what's called the predominant object. We start to recognize other things that are pulling our attention. Maybe it's an emotion, a sensation in the knee, a memory that keeps arising. And then we move into basically what they call choiceless awareness, another fairly ambiguous term, but just watching objects rise and pass, and Vipassana meditation, just recognizing that everything is changing, everything is unsatisfactory, everything is not self, the nature of Vipassana. But Citta is an interesting way to practice, because what we're doing is we're going, moving away from the object and really looking at the relationship that arises as a result of that object. So we notice attitudes of mind, which is a really great way to begin to notice, to be aware again of what are the glasses that I'm looking through. Am I looking through a sense of entitled to have the object, resistance towards the object, feeling like I don't deserve the object, angry at the object, upset about the object? All of these types of attitudes that we have towards experience, we don't really look at that so much. So in a way, we can do is begin to allow this citta to become, or this awareness, this citta, this mind, to sort of become the object of our practice, as we're actually looking for that. We could maybe even say what we're looking for is that which we're looking through, which I hope doesn't sound too confusing, but I really think that's the nature of what we're doing in this practice. So I want to talk a little bit about this third foundation of mindfulness. So many of us who are mindfulness practitioners from the Insight tradition or Theravadan tradition, in the last decade or so, there's been a lot of emphasis on Satipatthana, the development, the establishment of the four foundations of mindfulness. There have been many books written about it. Joseph Goldstein's recent book on mindfulness talks about Satipatthana. There's actually two books by Bhikkhu Anayu, some of you are probably quite familiar with, that outline these progressive stages. And part of the Satipatthana, again, in the third reflection, is mindfulness or contemplation of citta. Now, interestingly enough, if you look at the books, the chapters on citta are really quite small. Even in the Bhikkhu Anayu book, I think the chapter is like maybe 10 pages. So there's not a lot that is necessarily said about it. And so one of the things that we can do is to try to begin to see that there's a lot more complexity in the citta. So when we start to practice, when we start to develop mindfulness, we go from, again, the most basic features of bringing focused attention, concentration on the breath, the body, the first foundation of mindfulness, sitting with, paying attention to the sensations in the body, sounds, gravity, embodied awareness, that gains stability of mind. We open a little bit wider to the Vedana, feeling tone, hedonic tone, we might call it, the valence, we might use that term, and that all experience, every moment of experience, has a charge. It's a pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. Now, also, we don't really have agency over Vedana. You have a feeling arise, an unpleasant feeling. If somebody were to walk into this room right now and kick me in the leg, that would be unpleasant. I wouldn't be able to choose whether that was pleasant or unpleasant. We kind of inherit the Vedana. And where the agency aspect of chitta starts to become very valuable is we can notice that something's unpleasant. And we, of course, know that if it's unpleasant, we're going to not want it. We're going to want to get rid of it. We're going to be angry about it. We're going to be scared of it. We're going to be resistant towards it. We're going to have aversion towards it. Those whole systems of attitudes, those chittas, those little behaviors, resistance, fear, anger, not wanting, are probably going to circle the object very quickly. But we can be aware of that. We can recognize that. Oh, what's being known right now? Oh boy, a lot of resistance, a lot of aversion, a lot of not wanting towards this particular object. And in that moment, the way we can liberate the chitta is we can recognize that, and we can try to bring a different type of attitude to the experience. Something like acceptance, being open to the object, perhaps even starting to use Brahma-Vihara practice. Loving kindness, compassion, joy, and equanimity are all really great, wholesome chitta practices. Trying to develop that kind of an attitude towards a wide range of objects. And so, of course, when the object is pleasant, then we organize wanting it, having desire towards it, thinking we need to have it, feeling entitled to have it. So we're kind of set up neurobiologically through our conditioning, through the way that we were brought up, and through our histrionic relationship to a wide range of objects, that we're kind of set up to this, what they call in the third foundation of mindfulness, in the reflections on chitta, mental states, mental attitudes, emotions, we're set up to be dictated by greed, hatred, and delusion, which are, I think, fairly kind of barbaric terms, right? We all know that we're greedy towards pleasure, and we hate pain, but it's a little bit more complex than that. One thing I like about the Abhidharma is that it takes greed, hatred, and delusion and breaks them down into different factors. What are the things that make up greed? What are the things that make up hatred? What are some of the contributing mental factors that arise to it? Because greed, of course, is a very big concept in practice. We don't want to be driven by greed, but there's a very wide range of greed. There's just kind of like being inclined to wanting the object, to feeling like I need it, to feeling like I'm entitled to have it, and to feeling so entitled to having it that I'm willing to cause harm to other people to get it. And we see this kind of activity play out pretty greatly on the world stage. So we kind of just can know that we want to be able to overcome the forces of greed, hatred, and delusion by developing things like generosity, kindness, wisdom, understanding, these kinds of things that arise in our practice. So when we do the meditation earlier, one of the things that you might have noticed is I was trying to set us up this way of noticing the onset, the beginning, even the smallest sense of greed, hatred, and delusion by just the attitude of mind or the activity of mind of waiting for something to happen. You know, I'm sitting here, I'm meditating, I think this is kind of boring, ordinary, breath, body, what's the big deal? And then what happens is this attitude of mind wants to improve the state of mind, wants it to be better. And what that creates is a sense of restlessness, which in Abhidharma is known as one of the universal unwholesome mental factors. So anytime you're in an unwholesome mind state, restlessness is always there. And restlessness is kind of this, like, if this is my breath, I'm not connected to my breath when I'm restless. I'm just kind of hovering above it. I'm like, yeah, I see the breath down there. What's to be? I can't embody it. Restlessness is kind of hoping another better object arises. So we could say that that's greed. Greed is a strong word, but that's where the onset of it, meditatively, we can begin to recognize the presence of that. Waiting for something to go away is trying to recognize an attitude or an activity of not wanting, resisting, something about this pain in my knee. Maybe I had an argument with a friend or a loved one yesterday. I can't seem to get free from that. Maybe I feel sad or angry. And so there's some resistance. There's a not wanting, there's an aversion. So that can be known. Oh, there's aversion in the mind. There's anticipating in the mind. There's greed or hatred in the mind. And this delusion, which is by its very nature almost impossible to recognize. But I always try to ask myself the question, am I fully in touch with my experience? Am I here? And is it okay to be here? And so for me, the nature of the development of a wholesome citta is presence and ease. I'm here. It's okay to be here. Could it be better? Sure. Of course it could be better. Of course it could be less unpleasant. You know, that's not that profound of an experience to have. But it's an acceptance. It's allowing. It's I'm here. It's okay to be here. And also when we talk about, you've probably heard me use the words citta as unwholesome and wholesome, which kind of can have a moralistic overtone, which isn't always good. So I would hold it in a variety of ways. So we could have wholesome, kindness, friendliness, compassion, understanding, unwholesome, resistance, restlessness, hatred. Or we could say skillful and unskillful. This is a skillful state of mind. This is an unskillful state of mind. This is a skillful, wholesome state of mind that leads to happiness and ease. This is an unwholesome, unskillful state of mind that leads to suffering. Also, I like to talk about these aspects in the arena of emotional intelligence when they use this terminology that I really prefer of constructive and destructive. Is this a constructive attitude? Is this a constructive state of mind? Is this going to further cooperation between me and the object, the other person, the situation? Or is it destructive? It's unwholesome. It's going to lead to suffering, and it's going to give rise to self and other, and right and wrong, and good and bad, and that kind of destructive mind state. Destructive citta, which separates, destroys, creates suffering. Or is it constructive? It's maintaining cooperation. I don't like the object. I don't like this object. I don't really want to deal with this object. I want this object to go away, but I'm going to cooperate with this object because I know it's going to re-arise again. It's going to keep re-arising until I learn to relate to it in a skillful way. If I can have this constructive relationship,